who don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hey everybody, welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 342. I'm not even going to try and rhyme that with anything. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm your host sitting in this week for our dear beloved Iffy Wadaway. We will be hearing from him later in the program, but he's off in New York filming something. But the exciting part of all that is that he met Stuart Wellington in real life for the first time and at a Warhammer 40K event, no less. So the
his
universe...
natural element. Wow, exactly. His real natural habitat.
The universe is in harmony. Yes, no, we would never make that an unorganic thing. Joining me as always is the shimmering and lustrous queen of the Midwest, Drea Clark. What's good?
I like that you set up just a straight Iffy, like, fanfic scenario, and then use the word shimmering for me. Like, it's a real just, ooh, we're all just shining and absolutely fictional. I like it. What's good with me is actually tied back to, historically, this beautiful podcast network of ours, because someone that I met when guesting on the older podcast Pop Rocket, Margaret Wappler, has a new book out called A Good Bad Boy. And the other title of it, A Good Bad Boy, Luke Perry and How a Generation Grew Up. If you are a person of my age or roundabouts, you wanted to make out with Dylan McKay. And
he was bad, but so sensitive.
So bad, so sensitive. He's not bad. He's misunderstood, Alonzo.
That's right. That's right.
That's how they work. But I love him, and I loved him always. And then I saw him in the fifth Element and was like, oh, Luke Perry. And in Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Like, anyway, adore Luke Perry. Still tragic and sad that he passed away from a stroke in 2019. And Margaret's done a really beautiful tribute to his work and an analysis of what he brought as a star presence that was kind of unique to him. I always love, you know, a deep dive, and she's really got a beautiful handle on it. So yay for Margaret Wappler.
I did not know this book existed, but it just jumped to the top of my list. Between author and subject, I am in. So on this show, of course, we have a history of esteemed, distinguished guests. And as we've been hinting around, it's Max Fun Drive 2024, everybody. So we are thrilled to have with us from one of our beloved sister programs, one of the jewels, really, of the network. He is the co-host of The Flophouse. He is the voice of Tom Brokaw, if Tom Brokaw were really, really into Frank Herbert's Dune. Elliot Kalin is here.
Yay!
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I'm so excited to be here during Max Fun Drive. This is my second favorite Max Fun podcast after my own. I'm allowed to say that because that's if you had more of Tom Brokaw talking about Dune on this podcast, then maybe it would shoot to number one. I don't know.
We do need to up that quotient. Elliot, what's good?
I wish that I had something as excitingly new, as excitingly up to date as what Drea had. Instead, I have been enjoying the television hit of 2024. That's right. Michael Palin's Pole to Pole with Michael Palin from 1992, which is a 10-part travel series in which he goes from the North Pole to the South Pole and without taking a plane as much as he can, just by train and truck and things like that. And
wait, for real?
Yeah, this is a real series, and my wife and I, every now and then, will just be like, do we have to watch new TV shows? Can't we just watch, like, a Michael Palin travel show? And all the episodes are up on YouTube, and every night it's like, we should watch the next Pole to Pole, right? Like, we're very excited about it. And it's a 30-year-old show, so he's like, I'm going through Russia. Boy, communism is trouble, isn't it? And then he's like, 3 days after we left, the Soviet Union fell. And I'm like, this show, it's a time capsule. Wherever Michael Palin goes, trouble follows, you know?
This is blowing my mind. Like, first off, that Michael Palin from Monty Python had a travel show at all, which I did not know.
Oh, he had
several, I think.
He's done several. And when he was knighted a year or two ago, he's Sir Michael Palin, and it was mostly for his travel work and not really for his comedy work, which is astounding.
Dre, you're aware that Terry Jones is like an expert in classical literature, right?
What are you guys talking about? He's
written,
right,
I mean,
now?
Terry Jones wrote multiple books about medieval literature and Chaucer and things like that. Yeah. And
the Monty Python guys all went to Oxford or Cambridge. Like, they're wildly overqualified.
I mean, John Cleese is a business management and consulting expert. Like, he spent years making video training videos about business management. And Eric Idle and Terry Gilliam are just, that's just what you get. I don't think they have any stuff on the side.
And then, and then you have Terry Gilliam. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love this. I love this for all of them. Michael Palin, adore forever. Like, Fish Called Wanda, formative crush. Mm. Yeah. Awesome. And they're on YouTube?
Yes, these, I don't know if they're officially on YouTube, but if you look them up, they're there. They're all there. Anyway, they're good shows. Pole to Pole is a real fun one. Yeah.
See, that's new to me, so you did it. Okay, Alonzo, what's good with you? What are you going to bring to enrich my world, apparently?
I'll tell you, Drea. I had another great dessert from Dave White this weekend, but the dessert itself is not the good thing, so bear with me on this one. So he found a guy on Instagram, apparently like a Top Chef winner or something, who made this apple tart, and it was this whole thing where, you know, it's apples and butter and sugar, and, you know, you do the puff pastry and you flip it over and yada-da. Come to find out, after we consumed with great joy and delight this dessert, that he'd apparently done like the whole thing wrong. Like, the proportions were off. If he had tried to flip it over, it would have been a disaster. It just, like, none of the things that it says in the recipe were the thing. But it was so delicious and such a treat that I think what I'm saying is the good thing is that if you have the component parts of a thing that you like, maybe you're not going to like combine them in exactly the way that the experts tell you, but you know what? The odds are pretty good that you're going to wind up with something real yummy, and we did, in fact. Dave's waggling a finger at me, but I'm telling you, this is what happened.
He's waggling a finger because you just blew him up for like not following a recipe correctly. Yeah. But I really like the like central philosophy of that. That was lovely. A wisdom for the ages.
Trying to take a bigger picture approach.
Yeah. It sounds like he made that recipe better. He took a recipe and he didn't do it wrong. He did it better. That's my take.
I'm gonna go with that. This is our first official episode of Max Fun Drive. You might have seen a special kickoff episode featuring Drea and me in the feed on Monday. And if you've already gone to MaximumFun.org/join to upgrade, join, or boost your membership by a dollar or two, many, many thanks.
So many thanks coming your way, because I like to think gratitude is a good cornerstone of the Max Fun Drive. It's a guiding principle for us here anyway. But a lot of what's great about it is having our community support what we're doing through the drive by becoming members, by upgrading their memberships, boosting their membership, all of the things you can do. We'll get into all the cool stuff that we have planned. But it's great, great, great if you can jump on right now. It is awkward as hell to be doing this, because it's not something built ingrained in us to be asking for things, but we really do. It means a lot and we need it. And if you can jump on from the beginning, we're going to have some very cool sponsorship. What are they? Sponsorship levels? What are we calling them?
Gratitude bonuses?
Our driving numbers. Basically, once we hit certain numbers for our stretch goals.
Yes.
We will be giving you extra things. So we'll get into that. But please, if you've ever considered supporting us, if you already have and you're thinking of boosting, now is the time, right at the start of the drive. Gratitude.
Just to step in, we find ourselves in the midst of a battle between two types of models of entertainment and how it should work. One where kind of junk gets made by big companies and they, as much as possible, don't pay people to work on that. And two, where quality things get made and the people who make them are directly benefiting from it because that compensation goes directly to them. And that's the Maximum Fun model. Won't you please pick a side? Pick a side, the right side that for history, the one of contributing directly to the creators who make the things you like, as opposed to being like, oh, I guess I'll throw money at this thing that I don't really even want to watch or listen to, but I guess there's a billboard for it, so it's real. That shows how old I am that billboards are where I go to when it comes to corporate advertising. But
you think AI is going to create a conversation at this level? They are not.
Hi, this is producer Marissa. I wasn't planning on jumping in here, but I really want to piggyback onto what Elliot said, because there's a specifically cool thing about being a Max Fun member and the idea of membership. You know, the network, like, join to support this show specifically, right? Like, you love this show, come to support this show. But just in general, like, the network of Maximum Fun is doing something that is not like the most well-known, the hugest profile of everything, but like, by becoming a member, you become a part of a thing that is cool school and you know about all awesome shows like The Flophouse, like Max Film, like the other shows you might listen to on the network. And so it's cool to be a member. You're like an insider. You have the scoop.
Yeah.
So. And you're playing a direct role in making them happen and making them continue. So we appreciate your support, and we hope you will consider it during this year's Fun Drive, because we've got so much fun stuff happening to remind you why you love Maximum Fun. And part of that is today's episode. It's our How You Doin' month, and we've talked about several iterations of the Frank Herbert novel.
I so wish I could have been your guest every episode this month. I wish that I could have been here, but I'm so glad I'm here for this one in particular.
Oh, no, for sure. If we could only get you for one, this would be the one that I would want. This week, we're looking at The Dune That Never Was, which we'll further unpack in the documentary Yodorovsky's Dune. And later in the episode, we will pitch ideas for more documentaries about unmade movies and projects that never quite came to fruition. But first, it's time for It a Dick, our movie news segment, where we look at the week's headlines and ask ourselves the important questions. Is this important? Do I care? Drea, kick us off.
All right. A survey says that millennials and Gen Z want original movies and TV. It does feel like movie lovers have been shouting about this for nearly a decade, but now there is hard data courtesy of a new survey done by Tubi, one of Alonzo's properties.
Tubi!
The study focused on what people stream at home and found that 74% of millennials and Gen Zers say they would rather watch original stuff than remakes, reboots, or reimaginings. There was also major support in those demos for diversity, not just in terms of actors, but also diversity of genre, having both old and newer films to choose from. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, yes, of course. Like, this feels like it falls in the category of thing we all know and yet no one ever directly wants to deal with. You know, it is, if you are a number cruncher, you know, at a Hollywood studio, the safest thing is to pull out some bar graph that shows you, like, you know, audience awareness and the, you know, nostalgia factor and the blah, 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 blah. And there's no bar graph for new stuff. You have to gamble on new stuff. And there was a time when the people that ran this industry took that gamble because they cared about movies. And as the corporate forces have become more and more encroaching, we're back to the bar graphs. And so I hope this now becomes a bar graph for someone to say, like, hey, let's try something new. The audience is actually telling us, begging us that they want it.
I do wonder if there's also something tied to that. Just that I feel like the people making decisions are not passing on those. Like, it's the same people. They are just older, like, now. Mm. And so for them, the point of reference of what we're looking at for reboots or reimagining all the time, to them, the source material is like, oh, this is in the public consciousness. Everybody knows this. Whereas millennials, Gen Z, whomever, like, I don't know what that is. Like, this week on Twitter, there was something going about, like, someone's film teacher said, you know, my jaw dropped because I tried to tell my class about The Matrix and no, like, they had not even heard of it. Like, it was not a reference people knew, so they couldn't even get into, like, they were trying to use it as a shorthand to explain a genre or, you know, a certain kind of world building. And they were confronted with this class of students that were like, Kel Matrix. Like,
I got nothing.
Yeah, what are you talking about? And I remember running into that when I taught at USC, and like things that because I taught music video and was like, you all know the Smashing Pumpkins, Tonight, like, blank, what's a pumpkin? Like, so
why would you smash that?
Why? Leave the
They're delightful decorations.
Exactly. And so there's something.
Why do you hate gourds?
There's something about the idea of people who assume references are cooked into what everybody is watching and loving. And I think a lot of the things that we watch reboot that have the nostalgia factor, I'm like, I think you're overestimating who that is nostalgic for and what part of the viewing audience they represent.
I think you're exactly right that there's always a hunger in audiences for, show me something that is a little bit like I've seen before, but new in the other ways. I want a little bit that I can hook into, but it doesn't need to be the exact same thing. And I feel like there is no sign to me of how in the wrong direction we are than when I went to see Dune Part 2 at the theaters, and one of the trailers was for Twisters, the 30 years later sequel to Twister, a movie that nobody talks about. I'm sure it's somebody's favorite movie. And maybe people talk about it when they do histories of computer-generated special effects, because there was that cow that flew through the air and really impressed everybody at the time. But the idea that somebody was like, we could spend money on a new idea, or we could spend money on an idea so old it might as well be new, but it has the smell of a thing that I should know about, but I don't, so why am I interested in it? Like, it's very frustrating. Whereas, like, original ideas are cheaper than redoing old ideas, and you can get more out of them, and there's this kind of this disappointment, I think, that comes with when something lacks that spark of originality. And you look at certainly the Gen Z and millennial people I know, the stuff they like to watch are the things that are old originals. You know, they're sure. not watching mm-hmm. Friends and The Office because it reminds them of other stuff. They're watching it because they're like, oh, this is a good quality television show. Like, this is something I like, you know?
Yeah. As somebody said online recently, like, no subsequent Star Wars movie is ever going to give you the thrill of discovering yes. Star Wars for the first time.
Exactly.
And you know, and again, we talked about Cord Jefferson last week in his Oscar speech, where he's like, what if you made, you know, five $20 million movies instead of $100 million movie or whatever? And so, yeah, I think there's the jolt that you can only get from something that's brand new. And when you rehash something this hard, the best you're going to get is a familiarity factor, but that's the exact opposite of the sort of, you know, thrill of discovery. So yeah, I hope the message gets across.
Smallest footnote, shout out to Lee Isaac Chung, the director of Minari, who also is directing Twisters.
Progression. Well, the thing is also, I have nothing against the people making Twisters. I'm sure they're all talented workers. They're all doing great work. They need it. I'm glad they're all getting paid. But like, I love Minari. Like, I would rather he make anything else that speaks to that, or the other things that he can do that are original than to make Twisters. It's the same thing. I was really deluging myself with Dune stuff lately. So, because while I was rewatching the David Lynch Dune and rewatching Jodorowsky's Dune and getting ready for Dune Part 2, I was reading the book A Masterpiece in Disarray about the making of David Lynch's Dune. And that's one where David Lynch goes from Eraserhead to The Elephant Man to Dune. And it's one of those things where you're like, well, look, he's trying out something that's new for him and he's getting paid. It's an important step in his artistic progression to learn that that's not what he does. So maybe it's a similar experience here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. We can only hope that on the other end of it, if nothing else, he comes up with a brilliant satire of show business. Speaking of movies, in other survey news, 34% of adults say they would rather screen it than stream it. A survey from someplace called Habit X reports how the people surveyed would rather go to theaters than watch a movie at home, and why. Two-thirds of the adults expressed a preference for streaming over screening. The main reasons cited were the cost of movie tickets, the cost of concessions, the comfort of viewing from home, and maybe that guy who got caught masturbating at Love Lies Bleeding. Is this important? Do you care?
I mean, we talk a lot here about our love of the theater as a physical space, as, you know, film, as a spectator sport, as the community, shared experience. Communion of it. Right. Yeah. And so I'm certainly in a 34% who would rather screen, except for I'm also kind of on the other side, too. Like, I very much like watching things at home. Part of it is because I'm now, you know, a comfortable geriatric. And I really do like my own space. My tolerance of other humans declines every year. And there is something of we got very set up during the pandemic. Everyone has, and not everyone, many people have access to bigger screens now. You have access to more things you could watch at home.
High-speed internet.
I get all of those. Yeah, and if you're, exactly. And if you're paying for a family, if you're paying for a bunch of people to go. And I'm also someone who, I don't get concessions when I go to a movie theater, but that was a huge sticking point for people. They're like, if you want me to go to see a movie with my family, that's $150 or whatever. And I'm going to sit next to an idiot who's texting the whole time because people can't put their phones away. And I got to park.
I took my two sons to see Migration. And with food and tickets, it was a matinee at least. And with parking, it ended up costing me about $50. And let me tell you, that's an imbalance. That's not the amount of money you should pay to take two kids to see Migration. I'm sorry. Like, it's just too much. It made me so mad.
Yeah, and then so then when they offer it for you to in a couple of weeks to rent at home for, you know, $25, it seems like a steal.
Yes, yeah. I Dre, your situation is very much mine, where in a perfect world, I would go to the theater every time to see a movie, but it just doesn't fit into a modern life the same way, and it's expensive. And so for certain, and so I can understand why people go for the big movies that are large visually, and why I really wanted to see, I really wanted to see Poor Things in the theaters, and I missed it, and then suddenly it was on Hulu, and I'm like, you know what? This is a movie I can watch at home. You know, I don't need to see this in IMAX, and I feel like it didn't too noticeably change the experience to watch it on my television at home.
I'll say this ties into our third itadic in the smallest of ways. I think another component is, if I'm paying over $15, 20, like, LA tickets are pretty stupid. I generally go to matinees and they're still pretty stupid.
Yeah.
If I'm paying that much money and then I get there, I'm like, okay, bunch of trailers, sure. I don't like to watch trailers because I don't like the spoilers. But when you also start to pepper in all those ads, then it's the thing of, okay, pick where you're taking my money. Either I am here to be your eyeballs that you sold these ads for, or I paid a stupid amount for this ticket. Yeah, I turn on the old person crank real easy, so I get there. I am glad that there's still a group of people committed to the movie-going experience, because I think it's important culturally as well. And I think there's a sense of discovery there. I think when you're home, if the whole point guiding you is being comfortable, that also can come with the selections that you're making. You can maybe be a little less adventurous. People will rewatch things all over again, because that's like an anxiety reducer. But, yeah, you know,
if you're skidding into bedtime, it's going to definitely dictate what your picks are going to be.
That's interesting. That's an interesting way to look at it. Because I also feel like it could go the other way, that, for instance, like, I'm not going to go see Blue is the Warmest Color in a theater with other human beings in the room, because I will feel uncomfortable. But I'll watch it at home and be like, okay, I'm glad that I don't have to be around another person and see their reaction to what's happening on screen. You know,
that's fair.
That's one between of the you and your clergy, like to, okay?
Yeah. I think Poor Things could also fall in that.
Yeah, that's true. There were times in Poor Things where I was like, I'm not in the theater right now. I'm glad this is not one of the times when I was young and I would go with my grandmother to the movies, and the movie would turn out to be not one that I should see with my grandmother, and then afterwards I'd have to have a conversation with her about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. All right. One last, speaking of movies, last month, the class action lawsuit accused Amazon of false advertising and, quote, immoral, unethical, and oppressive behavior. The main thrust of the suit was about Prime members suddenly seeing ads during videos. See, ads. I told you this is a tie-in, which was not what they signed up for when becoming Prime members. This past week, Amazon's attempt to get that case thrown out was rejected. And lawyer Rob Freund on Twitter pointed out another facet of the complaint. Plaintiffs who had paid to purchase digital copies of movies or shows alleged that they never would have spent the money if they'd known that content could be deleted at Amazon's discretion. I will add, they are not involved in this, but Apple functions the same way. That ties back to one of our favorite themes of the importance of physical media. Is this important? Do you care?
Did you say physical media? What a coincidence.
Did I show the leg of physical media to Alonzo?
I was just thinking that very thing. Yeah. Look, it's one thing where we talk about how, you know, Netflix or Max or whoever can be streaming something and then yank it away. But we're talking about people who actually purchased, in their mind, in air quotes, a digital, you know, a copy of a movie. And Amazon's done this with books too, for Kindle, I hear, where suddenly, you don't own it anymore because, you know, the rights changed or whatever. And yes, if you wade deep, deep, deep into that thicket of the thing that you hit agree to at the end of the, you know, 10 paragraphs, it will tell you that's the case. But I would say for the most part, people don't think that, and they're like, oh, I'm buying it, you know, for as long as the earth is still spinning. And no.
So do you, like, if you went to rent something on Prime and you're like, ooh, I need my lawyer to check out this terms and conditions before I adjust it. That's totally right. Like, they use it as a licensing agreement.
Yes.
So when you're purchasing digital media, you're purchasing the licensing rights to it, and it's only for the amount of time that
Amazon provider
has
a license
it.
To it. Yeah.
So it's and their absolutely disingenuous claim is, oh, people know that. People understand that. And you're like, did you use the word buy? Then they do not know that. And the ad things ties into, like, how I feel about the ads in a theater, but the ads on Prime, like, there's other people who have added, you know, oh, they have a free ad supported or a lower tier ad supported, fine. But to change your base level of like, oh yeah, you're going to continue paying this, but now it has ads and you have to pay more to get rid of them. I'm like, you people, I know how much Bezos makes. What are you, F your faces.
Yeah, it is the streaming video equivalent to the whole thing now of like, you know, changing the can, the size of the Coke can, but charging an extra like $1 for it.
Or that program that Wendy's announced they were going to do that they backtracked on, where they were going to have surge pricing on their menu.
But apparently other people are already doing it. Dave and Buster's and other people.
They didn't announce Wendy's, it, which Wendy's mistake was in saying, we're going to try this.
Exactly. Yes. And they got the blowback they deserve on that one. And that'll learn them all, I hope. But they'll just keep doing it secretly and picking our pockets. Anyway, we have a wonderful conversation coming up about Yodorovsky's Dune. But first, have you heard the good news about Max Fundrive?
Have you heard the good news about Max Fundrive? Fantastic. A perfect entry point for me. It's all I want is for someone to ask me if I've heard the good news. And I have, Alonso. I'm glad you asked. We touched on it before, but to get to the heart of it, membership is what keeps our program and other programs on this here network truly independent. We can babble our nonsense raging against the Amazon machine because you know what? They ain't kicking us any ducats. You are. You are the Bezos keeping us afloat. And we're an opinion-based podcast. Like, all we do is talk about how we're reacting to material, to content, to stories in the world. And we talk about a lot of stuff that has sort of either deeper personal or socio-political elements to it. And it feels really good. No one has ever given us a note of like, ooh, you guys might want to shy away from expressing that kind of point of view. Like, we've been brought together and enabled and entrusted with giving everyone who listens our honest reactions to it. Having anybody ever respond to it is honestly an absolute gift and something I'm grateful for, my favorite word. But that's why the fund drive is something that it tells us, oh, people do really like what we're saying. They want to support our ability to say it the way we do.
And you know, we do what we do throughout the year, but during the fund drive, we stop and ask you to help us do that for the time that we're not talking about it on a regular basis here. But your support does mean everything to us, both on an emotional level and a practical level, frankly, because, you know, so much of we hear about the internet conditioning where people think, oh, I shouldn't have to pay for news anymore. I shouldn't have to pay for, you know, music or art or film or whatever. And, you know, as Elliot pointed out earlier, like, the good stuff does actually cost. And so if you want the good stuff, which is what we strive to deliver here at Maximum Film, we ask you for your support. Memberships start at the low, low cost of $5 a month. And that gets you access to the entire library of bonus content, not just for us, but for every Maximum Fun show. This year, following up the Iffy Wadaway collection that we did in years past, we're doing the Max Film Horny collection, which I guess is self-explanatory. Dre, you want to maybe dig into what that means?
Horniest film? Horny film? Maximum Horny! That's where we there landed on. Boom. Yep, I knew I'd get there. Yes, we are each picking one piece of cinema that represents true horniness in a theatrical expression, and then having everyone else watch it and then talking about it and somehow maintaining a friendship which allows us to make direct eye contact. So we hope that you will listen to it, enjoy it. I think we've picked some fantastic films. Also, some of us are on other people's BOCO. I guessed it on Comfort Creatures today. If you're like, wow, I wonder what Andrea Diane Clark has to say about her pets, animals in film, everyone else's pets, pets on the internet. There's a whole podcast you could listen to if you remember. So,
Elliot, you want to pipe in? Anything we should be looking forward to from Flophouse?
Sure. We have a cavalcade of Flophouse bonus content during this Max Fun Drive. There's already cavalcade on there. I mean, all of our shows have been building up a rich stock of bonus content. We've got audio commentaries that we've done. We did an audio commentary for Cats. We did an audio commentary for Bratz. We'll do any rhyming movie. We'll do them.
Minnesota Fats.
Yeah, exactly. But we have had a number of different role-playing game series that we've done for bonus content. This year, we're releasing one of our recent West Coast live shows, the show we did in Los Angeles where we talked about the movie Spawn from 1997, the movie that kicked off the superhero craze, a real trendsetter. That is only, producer Marissa just told us on chat. She was there. Thank you. That show is only going to be available on the bonus feed. That's an entire episode you'll only get in the bonus feed. And we're going to look at three movies from the filmography of Schlockmeister, Graydon Clark. We're going to look at Joysticks, which is a genuinely, there's one character in that movie that is genius, and the rest of the movie is terrible. I think we're doing Lambada, The Forbidden Dance, and nice. I forget what the third one's going to be. And so that's four whole episodes of The Flophouse that you will only get in the bonus content if you become a member. But that's okay. It's just $5 a month. That's one less comic book a month. That's one less king-sized Kit Kat if you go to the theaters per month. It's very little, if you can afford it, for this huge galaxy of content. And those episodes are going to be, the Spawn one is up now on the bonus content feed. Those other episodes will be appearing throughout the year. So don't just sign up for 1 month and then download it all, think you got it all, and then cancel. You got to stick around. You got to keep us one link in a month.
Hey, what's up? It's Iffy. So yeah, if you want to, maybe go ahead and become a member or upgrade your membership level, you can go to MaximumFun.org/join.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Alonzo Duralde. In the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
And Elliot Kalin of the Flophouse Podcast, another Maximum Fun Network show.
Thank you.
That's my full legal name.
That's good.
You've got the biggest driver's license I've ever seen.
It's huge, yeah, yeah.
Before there were Denis Villeneuve's Dune movies, before the sci-fi miniseries of Dune, even before our good buddy Dave Lynch's 1984 Dune, there was Yodorovsky's version, in theory anyway. Today's documentary came out in 2014 and is all about that legendary film that was never made. Drea, could you please summarize Yodorovsky's Dune?
All right, Yodorovsky's Dune is set, it's a documentary, as Alonzo mentioned. We are in sort of the early, mid-70s. We are following a director who has come up doing some absolutely gonzo insane films in Mexico. He's a French-Chilean director. He's working with a lot of French producers, so you already know it's intellectual and artistic chaos.
And smells like cigarettes.
And it smells like so many, it's just nonstop cigarettes, for sure. And Yodorovsky is approaching the text of Frank Herbert's Dune and reimagining it with all of just the creative insanity that is his brain at play. And he's tying together everything from musicians of the time like Magma and Pink Floyd to artists and designers like Geiger and Mobius and Chris Foss and special effects artists like Dan O'Bannon. And then he's like, you know what? I'm going to cast Salvador Dali and Orson Welles. Why not? Hey, is David Carradine, is Mick Jagger, are you free? He's putting together like the most insane people, the most insane visuals, all of this. And if you're like, wow, how have I never watched that? That's because it was not made. And instead we get this documentary piecing together the art, the connections, every famous white artist, male artist in the universe was pulled in for this one. And alas, to no avail, but what they left behind was this incredible book, tying it all together, every storyboard, every graphic, Yodorovsky's Dune.
Well done. Now, obviously, no film is greater than the one that doesn't exist, that we can only speculate and imagine about how amazing it might have been. But Elliot, I know this film that doesn't exist, this ephemeral notion of a movie, has a special place in your heart. Tell us about why it has such meaning for you.
Why? I love Dune. Let's just start with that. I love Dune. I'm a big fan of it. And
you're real Dune-y.
I'm real doing it. Yeah. As listeners of Flophouse will know that my alter ego, NBC newsman Tom Brokaw, is himself an even bigger fan of Dune. He occasionally hosts a segment called If It Ain't Brokaw, Dune Fix It. Alejandro Yodorovsky is one of these filmmakers where I find it so hard to penetrate his thinking. And I actually know his comic book work a little bit better than his film work because I'm scared of much of his movies. I'm scared of watching them and what the experience is going to be like. But like the science fiction work he did with Mobius, much of which was taking these ideas that he came up with for Dune and didn't put in, I'm familiar with that work even a little better. But there's something about the magic of thinking about this movie that you're like, there's no way this movie would ever work, but it doesn't have to because it didn't get made. Because rewatching this documentary again, watching it the first time, I was like, oh, if only who knows, this thing would have been so astoundingly strange and maybe beautiful. It would have had so little to do with the story of Dune that I've come to love, but it would have been such an amazing thing. But rewatching the documentary again for this recording, I was like, this movie probably would have been really bad. there's no way it would have come together. There's no way this ideal version. And so I do love it as this kind of thing that doesn't exist, but there's a vision of it that's in our heads now. Similar to I'm a big fan of the book I, Claudius by Robert Graves. And in the 30s, Joseph von Sternberg was making a version of it with Charles Laughton. They shot almost no footage of it, very little, and then it fell apart very quickly. And that's another one, and there's a documentary about that as well called The Epic That Never Was, I think. And that's another one where it's like, the version of this that could have gotten made, there's no way it would be as good as this platonic ideal that's floating in our heads. And the documentary does a really good job, I think, of just like really hyping you up for this movie that never got made. It's almost like you're watching the like EPK about that's promoting this movie that doesn't exist. And there's something about it. You're exposed to so much just straight on Yodorovsky talking to camera about his intentions. And you can tell that he is enjoying embroidering the story as he tells it. Like there are moments where you could tell he's kind of adding details to it that were never true, but he's thinking up in the moment and he likes them. And there's something I find that very, very, very endearing, very lovable.
Well, he's such an unreliable narrator because he talks about, I don't know where to find Mick Jagger. And then I go to a party and Mick Jagger's there and he wants to come talk to me. Like ABCO, which is the Rolling Stones' like publishing company, released The Holy Mountain. Like he totally had a connection to Mick Jagger already. Like knock it off, Alejandro.
This film, it's very funny too, the idea of how a documentary, I love how you're saying this, Elliot, like the fluidity of what this movie represents about, you know, oh, this is this process and this thing that was almost put together, but then how it also has a life of its own of what people imagine. And for me, it's also, I saw this when it came out like 2013, and it was right before I produced my first film. And honestly, even just a little over a decade later, having made a few, I'm not making anything with Mick Jagger and Salvador Dali, I'll tell you that, but...
Salvador Dali's not making a lot of movies these days. He's hard to book these days.
He is unbooked and blessed, as we call it now, exactly. But watching it now as like more, you know, like I said, a cranky geriatric and with sort of more industry experience, I 100% agree with Elliot. When I first saw it, I was like, oh God, the art that we missed out on. Now I'm like, oh, the train wreck. Like the absolute, like it, this thing was always going to be. And I was like, you watching this director, like as his producer, who again, that didn't work with him for another 35 years or something. And then they made something after this came out when they're like their 80s. I was like, of course he didn't. This guy is my nightmare as a producer. He's just spending money jetting across the world. He's like, I want this German designer. I want this British effects person. Like, I was like, this is not how you make a movie. What is happening right now?
It's like, I feel like there's a parallel universe where Yodorovsky's Dune got made and it was a debacle. And there's a documentary called Laughter in the Camps about the masterpiece that The Day the Clown Cried would have been, but they never got to shoot a frame of footage, whatever, all the tests are gone, you know, and like people just Jerry Lewis being able to spin the tale of what a masterpiece it was going to be. And it feels like it's a better movie in that way for not existing. At the end of the movie, they're kind of like, I think, drastically overstating the legacy of what came from
it.
But that was wild when they're showing the clips of like, look at all these things, and they show like this Geiger drawing, and then it's like next to a spherical building, and it's like, clearly that's biting it. I'm like, has no one seen a building before?
Yeah, I don't know. Even if the legacy of that movie is just that Dan O'Bannon was introduced to H.R. Giger, I never know if it's Giger or Giger, but that like if the only result of it is that Alien exists, like that's not the messianic, we're going to change the way humanity thinks vision Fair. That Yudorovsky had, but it is. But that's a legacy. I mean, to have created, to have indirectly led to a nearly perfect movie, I think, is astounding, you know?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at with this and with the I, Claudius and stuff, it's this sort of Schrodinger's movie, you know, where like it's in a box and no one can watch it. So it's either great or it's garbage, but who knows really? And yeah. This one at least has the benefit of having those incredible Mobius storyboards.
Yes.
So visually, the filmmakers here are able to give you a feel for what this movie was intended to look like. But you really have to wonder, like, how much footage a day were they going to get out of Orson Welles if they hired his favorite French chef to make him lunch every day?
Girl,
you know,
he's going to
be cranky in the morning, and he's going to be like drunk after lunch. So, and like, there's a 10-minute window of Orson. You know,
the idea that he would have even hung around for the production and wouldn't have found some way to get at it. There's a, I think it's in this book about the Lynch Dune I'm talking about, where they approach Orson Welles to play the Baron Harkonnen for the David Lynch movie.
Oh, wow.
And he goes, and apparently he's on the phone with, the way they tell the story is he's on the phone and they go, oh yeah, we'd love for you to play the Baron. And he goes, the floating fat man, and then hangs up. Like there's just silence and then hangs, like, you know, it's...
He's been down this road before.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder, I would love to read the storyboards of it myself, because so much of what Yudorovsky is interested in pulling together mm-hmm. are visuals and aesthetics. And then when he starts talking about the book and the movie, and I'm like, as someone who's been doing it now for a month, and I was like, oh, my guy, like, he has the loosest of understandings of what this book is. And his whole thing, when he talks about, he's like, oh, the ending in mine, they go full I Am Spartacus with Paul when he's killed. And then he's like, and then the planet achieves consciousness. And then I was like, my guy, this is loosely based on the idea of Dune. Like some character, some whatever, but like story of it. I was like, that's the part I'm like, that's absolute. Other than you are assembling something to intentionally have too many cooks in your kitchen, because you have all of these people are used to being the like definitive artistic voice in any room. You are someone who has just a very tenuous grasp of your source material.
I will say this, and or it ties into Orson Welles, the notion of like a lost film that actually winds up being something really great is underscored by the fact that we did finally get a reconstruction of The Other Side of the Wind. And it's extraordinary. Like, I think it's a really great movie. I feel like a lot of people didn't see it. You can watch it on Netflix. If for all the awful, dumb, anti-art things that Netflix has done and will ever do, they will get what's the thing that Catholics used to buy to get into heaven?
Indulgence.
Their eternal indulgence is that they reconstructed The Other Side of the Wind. Like, that gets them out of streamer purgatory, as far as I'm concerned. And so you look at that, like, okay, well, sometimes these unfinished, never quite cooked up projects, whatever, turn out to actually be awesome. But of course, I think that they're so the unicorn because, yeah, when people finally get to see this Day the Clown Cried footage, because, you know, Jerry Lewis gave it to some university or the Library of Congress, somebody's going to make it available. Like, yeah, of course it's not going to be any good. Like, there's not a mystery here.
If it's going to, I wonder if it's almost like when Terry Gilliam was trying to make Don Quixote, and Lost in La Mancha came out. It was a documentary about a movie that had barely gotten shot. And right. I was like, ugh, if only I could see that movie. Because this was years ago before Terry Gilliam had you know, gotten on everyone's bad side. But then he made that movie and he released it.
And no
I still
one
haven't
cared.
Seen it.
Yeah,
I haven't gotten around
too.
To it. It's available for free to watch. And I just haven't gotten around to watching it because I don't
care. People
have
seen Lost in La Mancha than will ever watch his actual completed Don Quixote movie.
Yeah. And there's something about the mystique of things like this that are often more powerful than the actual, like, my Flophouse co-host Stuart is always talking about how much he wished he could have seen Guillermo del Toro's At the Mountains of Madness. And I'm like, I don't think it would turn out to be as good as you're imagining it to be. And certainly, Drea, like you were saying, that there's so much that Yudorovsky wanted to insert into Dune where it's like, Even if this movie got made, it's like not really a Dune movie at this point anymore. Like when it's like, oh well, we have to impregnate Lady Jessica using the blood of Duke Atreides, and that turns into sperm. Like, well, there's nothing even in the book that would bring you to that point. No, you know?
And he's so enamored with that concept, he put it into a graphic novel later. He's like, this is how babies should be made. I'm pretty sure. I'll just add for any listeners who aren't familiar, The Day the Clown Cried is this famously unreleased film by Jerry Lewis, unfinished, unreleased, about a circus clown who's in prison at a Nazi concentration camp. So if you're like, anyway, I get that sometimes because my friends who listen are the ones who will not know what that is, and I think it's a great comparison point.
It's speaking of frames of reference, this shows how far mine is off that I'm like, oh, there are people who don't know about the unfinished Jerry Lewis Holocaust clown movie. Like, all right,
that was never released.
Yeah,
where have you been?
Jeez, who are you talking to?
Made long after he was already like over the hill and people didn't want to see his movies anymore. Yeah.
Oh, and it's also meant to be slightly comedic, whatever, all of it, absolute insanity. Speaking of insanity, can we discuss one of my favorite things that I had somehow completely pushed aside when reviewing this, which is Yodorovsky had cast his son, Brontis, to play Paul Atreides, our hero, and was also like mirroring the lines of what the Duke did. Like, he was like, oh, okay, so my son's going to play this, and for him to properly play this, I'm going to, like, sequester him and have him train in all these insane martial arts.
He's going to train in martial arts for 6 hours a day or something like that, every day.
Yes.
At the age of 12.
Years. From the age of 12. Years. And that when he shows up, this is the most suspenseful part of the movie to me, not whether the film is going to get made or not, but that, like, when you see Brontis talking, he's in a different setting than Yodorovsky is for most of the movie. And I'm like, there's no way they have a good relationship. And then later on, they're in the same shot together in the same interview, and he says something really supportive to his dad. And I'm like, this is the story that needs to be told, is how this relationship was not destroyed by this process.
His dad, who he refers to his dad as Alejandro Yodorovsky. I was like, yes. He, like, sitting next to him, he was like, well, Alejandro Yodorovsky. I was like, your father, that old man sitting right next to you? Their entire thing, knowing, again, because we've been doing it, knowing the story of Paul Atreides, like, watching the whole, like, we watched his training sequences, we watch all this, and Brontis, his son, Elliot, you might have escaped this because you didn't list it in your thing, but I'm guessing you didn't. Last week we talked about the first episode of the sci-fi original miniseries Frank Herbert's Dune.
That's why I never got around to watching that, because there's no way they're going to be able to do it the way I want them to do it. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, you're doing fine. But I was very critical of the what I thought middle-aged looking man that they cast as Paul in that. Alonzo, tell me the guy from the miniseries didn't look like Brontis. Tell me he doesn't look like Brontis. He does.
There is a bit of a, yeah.
He's got that round, blonde moon face, the Luke Skywalker head shape. I was laughing so hard when he popped up, and I was like, who's this blonde height? Oh my gosh, this is his son. They had to, like, train in all this nonsense and, like, give up part of his life for, again, a movie that was never made.
And they would say, another example of how this, the ongoing influence of Yodorovsky's Dune, even though it was never made. They cast a guy who looks like his son, you know.
Yeah, I can't believe they didn't include that.
So, I mean, I this is a fascinating movie. I mean, I think there are so many stories to be told in film history about the movies that never got made because somebody was unavailable or the financing fell out or whatever. Like, you know, this is part and parcel of the thing. And the fact that this one just has, like, this, all this documentation, all those storyboards and the book with all the drawings.
It has such amazing imagery that they can. And that's the one thing about it that is always frustrating to me, is it's like, I almost would rather the movie just be them, every single page of that book. Like, it's so gorgeous, and you just get to see glimpses of it. And knowing that one of those books went up for auction a couple years ago, and it sold for a massively inflated price because this consortium got together thinking they would be able to make the movie if they owned the book.
Yeah, they thought even they got the rights.
Yeah, which is bonkers. They don't know how rights work. That you, I bought a copy of this book. I guess I own it now, and I can make it. They're the people who are mad that their books disappear on Amazon, I guess. But
people with access to $1 million. The people that don't understand how rights work. Oh, yeah.
But it definitely the movie is strengthened by having those amazing images to show.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you something to sort of like hook onto and figure out, give you some notion of like, well, maybe I would have, you know, it takes it out of the realm of the theoretical, I guess.
Yes.
Now is the time on Maximum Film when we vote. As I'm sure you know, Elliot, we have three choices here. Is this a movie that you would say screen it? Is this a mm-hmm. movie you would say stream it like 34% of adults? Or would you say skip it? What do you got?
Your categories are so much better than our categories on the Flophouse.
Screen it's the 34% P.S.
Yeah. We constantly find in our categories on the Flophouse are good, bad movie, or movie we kind of like, and we're always like, oh, well, it doesn't really fit any of these, which is, amazing. We should change the categories at this point.
I say screaming a lot, so, you know, we also kind of fall into middle ground.
Good scream it, yeah.
And if you feel like you need to give this one any number of wormy boners, you are allowed to do so.
That's but more Stu's you. Thing, the wormy boners, but the... you should definitely stream it in that you should definitely watch it, but I don't know you need to see it in a theater necessarily. You know, I think
that's
there's
a solid stream it. Yeah.
Yeah. There's certain documentaries, like I've never had the chance to see Harlan County, USA in a theater. I would really love to, you know, but with this, I feel like it works really well as a streamed thing, but also because if you're watching with somebody else, you can talk with them about it and just be like, that's crazy. Or like, can you imagine if they did that? Like, what is that? Which I think would add to the fun of it.
For sure.
I am also a stream it. I find it an enjoyable view. I think it is not going to teach you how Hollywood works unless you want to see how Hollywood doesn't work. Cause in fact, that is what it's teaching you. But I also think the subtext lesson is if you want some insight on how an absolute wild card artistic entitled genius is approaching things, so you can just mainline a little of that yourself, this is the movie for you. If you're like, you know what energy I want to bring into my day is the assumption that I can get Salvador Dali to play something, then find this. Unleash it in yourself. I watched this. It was fully a lot of, oh man, the absolute audacity of this just assumption that these people, good for you, guy. Way to live that. Like, can you imagine going through life with that? Just like, just righteous confidence.
The only moment that really, even the stuff where he's talking about forcing his son to do all this training, the moment that really gets me in the movie is when he goes, we sell our souls for this shit in our pockets, this shit. And he pulls out an enormous handful of money from his pocket.
Yeah. It's huge, like 100 euros. Yeah,
it's all crazy. And he's like, and for nothing, for what? It means nothing. And I'm like, well, you seem to have a lot of it. It doesn't mean anything to
him. He's in one of his four homes in three different countries. Yeah.
Yeah, I am also solidly a stream it. This, I think, goes in the kind of hubris hall of fame alongside movies like Lost in La Mancha, the film about Henri-Georges Clouzot making Inferno with all the money and all the time he needed and then never finishing it. You know, I think there's a lot to be learned, especially for, you know, like the scrappy indie producers out there like Wondrea Clark, who has to make the most out of a little and, you know, stretch every penny. And this is the opposite. And when you get the opposite, sometimes nothing happens. So, you know, go figure. We will be right back with more looks at things that never quite came about. But first, dear friends, let's talk a little more about Max Fun Drive. We're so thrilled to be in the middle of it. It gives us a chance to brag on this network a little and how much we love working here and how much we know that many of you directly respond to the program, whether you are sending us hotline questions, whether you are interacting with us on social media, or just sharing the show with other people, tell them, hey, check this out. And Fun Drive is the time of year where you can take that enthusiasm and make it manifest with actual contributions that keep the joint afloat.
And I think, you know, it really feels good to be a part of a podcast network that also is a co-op with its employees so that they can do things the way they want to do and feel good about it.
So, we already mentioned Maximum Horny, and I'm sure it's been haunting you ever since you first heard about it, as it should. And we'll be.
I have to assume
those.
That the Maximum Fun site crashed when so many people rushed to join when they heard about Maximum Horny. Don't worry, the site's back up. You can still join.
If you were wondering why the internet went down, it is because this episode came out and people got to minute 23 when we first said that, or whenever it was. But we might, we also have some other exciting drive stretch goals going that Alonso had alluded to. We like one of our very favorite and our kind of first tier one that we're hoping to get to. Every year we put a listener that chooses the movie we want to watch. That is always insane. They always pick something out of left field. It is very fun. And if you are a new member, an upgrading boosted member, you get to be in the mix, and then they randomly sort you out and pick you, and then you get the call. Don't you want to get that call? And then we have in our episodes, we have the whole thing I'm most worried about in terms of having Iffy try and teach Alonzo and I. I don't know what Warhammer 40K is, let alone how to approach playing it.
Oh, it's the preeminent miniatures battle game set in the grim, dark world of the future.
Yep. All that track.
Well, that was our first lesson.
All that track. It's going to be a lot of me feeling like an absolute dullard, but doesn't that sound fun? I'm very funny when I feel stupid, so let that entice you.
Yeah, if you want to hear Dre and me actually develop a migraine, this is the way to do it, I think. And we just need 350 listeners to join Booster Upgrade.
Exactly. And then one of the other things that we're doing, and as a professional programmer, Alonzo also has been a professional programmer. Iffy knows what a programmer is, so is a slightly adjacent qualified. But we're going to be personally programming a film that you like. If you are signing up, if you're doing all this, there'll be elements of it. We'll release all those details later. But the idea is, we will get an idea of your favorite kind of movies, and we will pick a movie for you. Personal recommendation.
A personal pan recommendation.
From our team to yours. So we're looking at all of these. We're looking at even more of these three-part series as bonus content. We discussed doing Maximum Sandwiches, and that is still a real favorite for me. I think what the real question comes down to is, please, will you join us as a member? And support us in all of this shenanigans, but also with just the central idea of liking what we do and acknowledging and championing us to continue doing more of it.
If you have the means, if you have the ability, please support us in the work that we do and support the co-op-owned Maximum Fun Network, which is, you know, truly operated and owned by its employees who put the work in. And it's a way to keep cool stuff out of the hands of gross people, because that's just become a thing that's harder and harder to do in this day and age. So we hope you can head over to MaximumFun.org/join and make that happen.
That is the greatest slogan for Max Fun Drive, keeping cool stuff out of the hands of gross people. Like, that's what an inspiring mission statement.
That's the heart of it.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm still your host for the day, Alonzo Duraldi, here with
Drea Clark.
And me, Elliot Kalin, America's Rascal.
We all know lots of stories about movies that never got made. Is there a real life story about a scrapped project that you'd like to see get the documentary treatment? I ask you, Elliot Kalin.
Well, here's the thing. I was mentioning in our discussion earlier, there's a number of documentaries about movies I wish I could have seen. There's the one about I, Claudius that never got made. There's the documentary about The Other Side of the Wind is also really good. I think I'm going to stretch the rules a little bit. I'd really like to see a documentary about Coyote versus Acme, because apparently that's the only way I'm going to get to see that movie, even though it's finished.
Yes.
So if somebody out there can, I'll look at the storyboards for that. I don't care. Make a movie about that movie. You know.
Wait, fill in our broader world for what Coyote versus Acme was.
So any of our listeners
Day the Clown Cried people that slept
on. Yes. For anyone who still doesn't figure it out, who's still learning about Day the Clown Cried, Coyote versus Acme is a movie that was made last year, right? Or the year before last, starring Wile E. Coyote and Will Forte and John Cena. That's right. This is a movie that full disclosure, I at one point pitched to be the writer on, did not get that job. And so I was not hired. It was very early in my pitching career. But
written by Academy Award nominee Sammy Birch, who was just nominated for May December.
Yeah. And they've been trying to make this movie for years based on this one. Is it Ian Frazier who wrote the original New York? It's based off of like a New Yorker humor piece where Wile E. Coyote is suing Acme for all the products going wrong. They've been trying to make it for years. by all accounts, anyone who's seen it, and I never know if this is just everyone just talking about it because it's not out there, they're trying to make it sound best. Everyone who's seen it says it's really good and says it's like a really fun movie and that it came out really well. But Warner, which made it, they own all the Looney Tunes stuff, they decided that it was really of better use as a tax write-off, much like they did with the Batgirl movie or Batwoman movie.
Batgirl.
It's, I mean, she's getting older. Batgirl, you'll be a woman soon. They just decided, well, we're not going to release it. And that for a moment, and there was a big outcry, and they're like, we'll see if another studio wants to distribute it. And then the studio said, can we give you money for this? And they said, no. And so they'd rather it be a tax write-off that never gets seen. Sometimes movies like that come out. The movie Nothing Lasts Forever, I eventually was able to see, even though that was a tax write-off movie that was not released. But I really want to see this movie, and it just looks like it's not going to happen anytime soon. So I guess the workaround would be a documentary about the making of it, where it'd be called like Coyote versus Acme versus Warner Brothers or something like that.
And maybe versus David Zaslav.
Yeah, versus Zaslav. Yeah, and they'd sneak a lot of footage in there. But that's the one that I'd really like to see.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Smart choice.
And mine is a super stretch, but follow me here. So, okay. In 1970s children's television, few people were as hot as the brother team of Sid and Marty Krofft.
Yeah, sure.
They gave us such trippy puppet-based shows as H.R. Puffin Stuff, Lidsville, Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, Land of the Lost, on and on and on.
Are you aware of their puppet cabaret that appeared at the 64 World's Fair, where they were told it was too sexy at first? They had put tops on the puppets, and then attendance was low at the World's Fair, so they were like, you could take the tops off the puppets.
Oh my god.
Les Poupées de Paris, I believe that.
Yes, that's right.
Called.
That's right.
So having conquered television, what would they do next? Naturally, of course, theme parks. And so in Atlanta, they opened the world's first entirely indoor theme park in what is now CNN Center, where the CNN network is based. And you had to ride up to it on the world's longest escalator. And it was an entire, magical, imaginative theme park based on the visions of Sid and Marty Krofft, who had previously loaned their characters or had rented their characters to Six Flags Over Georgia. But this was going to be their baby. And it was open for about 3 months and then died and was never heard from again. And so if you're a theme park person, like any scrap of like a bag from their souvenir store is a highly sought collectible. It's just this thing that came and went. I never even went. I grew up in Atlanta. I was the right age to go, and it was gone before I could even get there.
Oh, that's too bad.
I want to see a documentary about that stupid theme park and what happened to it and what it even looked like and why it failed. It's a greatest lasting legacy is that there is a lengthy scene set on that really long escalator in Robert Altman's HBO series Tanner 88. Because the 88 Democratic Convention was held in Atlanta, and CNN Center was one of the major places that things were happening. But anyway, that's the doc I want to see.
That, I want you to know, I think 85% of that you could have just made up right now. That's the degree.
That's the beauty of it.
That sounds so insane to me. Starting with, as someone who, grew up and lived very near Bloomington, Minnesota, the home of Mall of America, mm-hmm. with its indoor... yes. theme park. I'm like, what? They did one in Georgia first? That can't be. We have so little to claim.
Yeah, but yours is still open, so that says something.
Yes, that is fair. Ours is still functioning because Minnesota gets it done. Is what's up, Alonzo. Mine is sadly going back to movies, although I really want to get into like theme park exploration because I truly think what you just said is insane. There is and from the year that Jodorowsky's Dune came out, there is a film that was announced as being in development. It had a writer, director, lead actress, a producer of note, all of these things, and it never happened. And if you're wondering, was it going to be a movie about Mae West's life? Mae West, again, for the people who don't know who Jerry Lewis is, a name, an old Hollywood name who did things like
legendary code actress and writer from the 30s and 40s whose stage and later screen work constantly defied what censors would allow.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The woman ended up in jail on obscenity charges at one point. Just a badass. So in 2013, they cast, and she also did movies up to her 80s.
Oh, yeah.
They cast Bette Midler to play Mae West in a film written by Harvey Fierstein, produced by Jerry Weintraub, who did Beyond the Candelabra, and directed by William Friedkin of, sure, The Exorcist, The French Connection,
and I think Cruising, which Jerry Weintraub also produced.
Exactly, exactly. So like all of these things, I was like, I want that in my eyeballs. And Bette Midler, if you're like, huh, 2013 doesn't... Yes, Bette Midler was definitely deep, late in her 60s when she was cast to play Mae West. All of this are things I want to see. And to have that many people at that level together and have it announced... I'm like, oh, something went terribly wrong. Because you don't announce it. Like, all of those pieces, you're like, well, I know exactly the direction this train's headed. So if something goes wrong with that train, it's going enormously wrong. Anyway, I really want to know what's up with that.
Well, that sounds amazing. Yeah. This is producer Marissa. I know that I created this prompt. So,
and you just happened to have a great answer.
A little bit of self-dealing here. Very interesting. Yeah.
Well, it's really going to sound like self-dealing once I say my answer. But I promise I wrote it. I thought of this like I woke up from a sleep this weekend and I had thought of this C-block prompt. I don't think I have ever brought up before, maybe not even privately to you guys, my deep and abiding interest in Sweet Valley High, novel series created by a woman named Francine Pascal, who is still with us in 1983, that kept on going kind of into about the year 2000, but it still exists in various forms. It's had spinoffs over the years. Well, right around the time, like a little bit after Juno, as I recall, there were reports about how Diablo Cody was going to be making a Sweet Valley High movie, which sounded delicious. I mean, Sweet Valley High is such a strange, like, perfect world, and yet, like, terrible things happen. It's too saccharine to take seriously, but then, you know, people get kidnapped, you know, all the time.
This isn't your niece's Babysitter's Club.
Right, exactly. This is like Babysitter's Club for like cool girls. But yeah, the movie never got made, and I think that probably what happened is that Diablo Cody wrote Young Adult, where you guys mentioned Waverly Prep back a few months ago when we were talking about American Fiction, and we were proposing Hall of Excellence candidates about
fake
book series. But, you know, through channels, I have heard that there has been a Sweet Valley High, like a new Sweet Valley High series, because there had been a series in the 90s, in the works at various places for Brittany ages. Daniels.
Yeah.
Yes, the original one in the 90s was, yeah. But Francine Pascal, I think, has her fingers in the whole deal a little bit too deeply, is my understanding, for it to go forward in a way that would work. All this to say, I would love to see a documentary about all of that shit. Just all of it. Not just the Diablo Cody part, but like, why was there not another TV series? Mm-hmm. What's going on here?
That none of these documentaries exist just makes me miss the Trio Network that much more.
Yeah.
Does anybody remember Trio?
That was their bread and butter. Yeah.
Oh, man, they did.
Trio was like, it was that their slogan should have been stuff that failed, but a whole network of it.
Yes.
Like, they had the Brilliant But Failed series, but like, they seemed dedicated to just airing things that did not work on other networks.
They had a documentary about Heaven's Gate that you can find on YouTube. It's fascinating. They did a whole thing about like how the Golden Globes were always kind of a joke. They reran Cop Rock, like they were there first.
Yeah.
So,
like, Brilliant But Canceled. That was the thing. It was called Brilliant But Canceled.
Yes.
And they played the Fargo pilot that Edie Falco starred in. That was not made not long after the movie came out. Like, yeah, Trio would have been perfect for that. Oh, that back when carriage fees allowed cable to proliferate in beautiful and diverse ways. What a wonderful time.
Remember narrow casting?
I miss it so much. As someone who works professionally in television, I miss the TV biosphere of the 80s, 90s, and very early 2000s so much.
Oh,
so much possibility. So much potential.
Here.
the real possibilities now come, of course, with our staff picks. It could be any movie at all, old, new, streaming in theaters, you name it.
Got Dre, made, didn't get made.
Didn't get made. Made yet, no, we're yeah. not gonna, we're not gonna, we don't judge. Kick us off, Dre.
I definitely have one to kick us off. It is a new release called Snack Shack. Mm. It's by Adam Remeyer. His first film, Dinner in America, was a previous staff pick of mine. I really like his flavor. It's this Snack Shack is set in 1991 in Nebraska, so it's already really speaking to me. It's it's two best friends who get a job working at the Pool's Snack Shack. It's right there in the title. And so it's like, oh, we're going to be entrepreneurs, but it has that very sort of 80s, 90s element of hijinks and summer, and they're like, oh, like crass jokes and making money at the thing by, like, they charge the kids extra because they write the word fuck in ketchup on a hot dog, and the kids are like, oh, it's so naughty. It's just a very fun summer throwback that also has a little more sort of substantial storytelling to it. And it stars, there's a new kid named Connor Sherry, who I hadn't seen before, and then Gabriel LaBelle. And yeah, it's a very fun view. It's out now. This is indie original filmmaking. We talk about it all the time. Check it out.
Elliot?
I'm going to recommend a not new movie, but not as old as the movies I often recommend on the Flophouse. This is a movie that I rewatched recently for other reasons, but it's also a documentary. It is also about uncompromising artists whose dreams dash against the rocks of reality, and that's Anvil, the Story of Anvil from 2008.
Yes!
It's nice. Like it about the Canadian heavy metal band Anvil, and the two main headliners of the band, Steve Lipscudlow and Rob Reiner, but Rob is spelled with two B's. It's not the Rob Reiner from the movies and All in the Family. And it starts out feeling like this is a real life Spinal Tap. This is a goofy band. These guys are just failures. But as the movie goes on, their dedication to each other and kind of refusing to give up on this dream that is becoming increasingly unrealistic, but which they cannot give up on. And it's not that they necessarily want to be rich and famous, although they'd like to be, but that they want to be recognized by their peers in the metal community. They had this one shot in the early 80s when they were almost the band, and then at the last minute, Metallica became the band. Mm-hmm. And when you look at Metallica's career, you're like, well, they sustained. They weren't a flash in the pan. You know, they've been a huge band for 40 years. But it's both a really funny movie, and I found it to be just very touching watching it again now. I first saw it when it came out when I was a younger man, and now watching it as an older man, it's just very I find it very endearing. And so it's another documentary whereas Yudorovsky's Dune is about a guy who does whatever he wants all the time, and then eventually he has the one big disappointment that he doesn't get to make this crazy Dune movie. This is about these guys who are constantly disappointed in what they're doing, and yet they can't let go of it. You know, they're just so dedicated to making this dream happen. So I really liked it a lot.
Nice.
My friend Rebecca Yeldum produced that, and that's a Sundance title from 2008.
Yeah. It's nice. It's really
never
good.
Ends. Trey has got them all in her mental Rolodex. So my pick is also very much on the indie side of things, and maybe kind of sort of a little bit ties into Coyote versus Acme. This is a film that is currently touring the country called Hundreds of Beavers. It is directed by Mike Chesick, starring the incomparable Ryland Brixen Cole Twos. The two of them co-wrote the film. It is a mostly silent black and white comedy about an Applejack manufacturer whose crop is ruined and then must capture the titular Hundreds of Beavers to win the hand of the daughter of the local trading post guy. I can't begin to describe this movie. It is bananas. The beavers are played by guys in beaver costumes that look like, good, you know, sports team mascots. Good. And this film resembles a collaboration between like Chuck Jones and Tex Avery of Looney Tunes and Guy Madden. Like, there is such... yeah, trust me. This movie is bonkers. And you think, okay, this is a fun idea for a 25-minute short or 45-minute short. There's no way that it's going to maintain this level of lunacy and laughs and creativity for the full 108-minute running time. And let me assure you, oh, yes, it will.
Oh, wow. You obviously had me at Tex Avery meets Guy Madden.
It's making its way around the country. It, you know, they're kind of releasing it city by city. So go to the website and see when it's going to come near you, or if you already missed it, maybe it'll come back. I don't know. But it's way too early to talk about the best of the year. But I'll say this. If I see a bigger surprise to me in 2024 than Hundreds of Beavers, this is going to be a great year.
Awesome.
I got to see this movie. I wasn't aware of this movie at all. And everything you're saying about it makes me want to see it so much.
I think you'll really like it. I wholeheartedly recommend this. And I also wholeheartedly recommend that everybody go to MaximumFun.org/join. If this show matters to you, if the Flophouse matters to you, if all of the Max Fun shows matter to you, know that it's your support that allows us to keep making them.
That's right. And there are several cool thank you gifts you can check out when you head to MaximumFun.org. And you can only get them for the 2 weeks of Max Fun Drive if you want your hands on that good stuff. You got to do it in a timely fashion. One of those is a cool collectible pin representing our show. And some of you may remember how I have no ability to segue in a cool way during It a Dick. So I always say, speaking of movies, and that's our pin this year. I'm so excited. It is on a sort of upturned classic cinema popcorn bucket, and it looks very cool. And you know what? There's an ellipsis in there for good measure. You can see what it looks like on our social media accounts and when you go to MaximumFun.org to join or upgrade your membership. And everyone who joins or upgrades to $10 a month or more will be able to buy extra pins after the drive, and that all goes to support charity.
Yes. So find it all, learn everything you need to know at MaximumFun.org/join. Our big, big thanks to Elliot Kalin, sir. Yay! We are so
thank
thrilled
you so much
you could join
for
us.
Having me. I would have been personally insulted if I didn't get to be a part of Dune Month. I was so happy to be here. So happy to be here on a Pledge Drive episode. I could just talk about it for just a sec before we go. It's such a necessary thing. It's such a special thing. It's such an appreciated thing when you contribute to us, when you join as a member, when you upgrade your membership, when you boost. It is something that makes these shows possible, and it is a way of showing that we've connected with you. One of the things I love about podcasting is that it is a way to connect with people that you otherwise would never have the chance to speak to, and to really get straight into their brains in a way that no other medium really allows you to. And by contributing back to us, it's almost like we are sending out that signal into space, and it's bouncing off an alien planet, and the alien planet is sending a signal back in the form of cash money, which is the best kind of signal, and saying, I hear you, and I like this, what you sent me. It's like I'm just a castaway, and I sent out a message in a bottle, and I just want someone to hear my SOS, and...
Yep.
There's lots of bottles on the shore. I don't
you
remember how the song
at
is. Yeah, lost at sea. Yeah.
I know what you're doing.
Okay, yeah. I kind of forgot.
A million bottles washed up on the shore.
Yeah. It's so many.
I don't know if we're going to get there on this fun drive, but we'll certainly try.
But thank you so much. Speaking for myself as a Max Funster, it's so appreciated, and we're so thankful for it when you support us. So please go to MaximumFun.com/join and do just that. And we'll thank you in your dreams, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you feel the need to support after hearing all the good reasons that you should, then go on down to MaximumFun.org/join. There you can, you know, pledge to be a member or upgrade your membership level if you can. And if you can't, you can help us by like spreading the word of mouth, getting more friends involved, and, you know, especially your rich friends. Get your rich friends in it. And when you get them involved, well, then, you know, not only do you have something to talk about with them, but you get to support Max Fun.
100%. Anything else besides Max Fun Drive you would like to tell our listeners about that you've got coming up, Elliot?
If I'm allowed to promote non-Max Fun Drive stuff, then I'll
go
mention
for it.
That. Okay. I've got a new comic book series coming out in April from Dynamite Comics that is called Disney Hercules. It is the first issue comes out. It's a continuation of the story of Hercules from the movie the same name. And I got to bring in all sorts of other Greek myth stuff, so I'm very excited about it.
Oh, cool!
In the first issue, I introduced my new favorite character that I'm hoping becomes everyone's favorite character in the mythos, and that's Galatea, the living statue. Check it out.
I can't wait for your Medea 3-episode arc. That's going to be great.
I previously did a Hades series where Medea had a cameo appearance, and I did get to make a Medea's family reunion joke in that, so I was very excited about it. In addition to the Flophouse, my major podcast off of the Maximum Fun Network. I don't normally recommend you listen to any podcasts that are not on the Maximum Fun Network, but
we'll
at
make
the same
an exception.
Time, yes, thank you. For this one podcast, which I only make exception for because I'm making it, I have teamed up with Roman Mars of 99% Invisible, and we're doing a podcast all through this year called the 99% Invisible Breakdown, The Power Broker, where every month we are covering 100 pages of Robert Caro's The Power Broker, which celebrates its 50th anniversary this year, one of the all-time great works of American history writing, biography writing,
non-fiction.
Journalism. Yeah, nonfiction. Just, it's an amazing work. It's a 1,200-page book. If you've always wanted to try it, but it have been put off because the book is enormous. Literally, when I was rereading it for this podcast, I would lie in bed with it on my stomach, and my stomach would hurt because the book was too big. Like, I had to stop doing that.
I was wondering why your biceps were ripping through your shirt, and now I know.
It's from lifting the path to power. Look, the Power Broker Muscle Build Challenge, it'll turn you from a 98-pound weakling into the hero of the beach in just 60 days. You know? And those are the things that I'm promoting. I won't mention anything else, I promise.
Well done. Drea, of course, as always, thank you for another wonderful show. If you, our dear listeners, have a comment or suggestion about this week's program, send us an email at maximumfilm@maximumfun.org or find us on any of our social media channels. All those links are in the show notes. Next week, we're bringing it home, talking about the brand new Dune Part 2. Our delightful producer is Marissa Flaxbart. Our delightful senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun.
Maximum Fun. A worker-owned network.
Of artist-owned shows.
Supported
directly
by you.